saw the pile of documents they'd prepared. "Good morning, Mr. President," Andrea Price said. People started to rise from their chairs. Ryan waved them back down and pointed to Murray. "Dan," the president began, "what do we know?"
"We found the body of the pilot about 2 hours ago. Good ID. His name was Sato, as expected. Very experienced airplane driver."
"We're still looking for the co-pilot." Murray paused. "The pilot's body is being checked for drugs, but finding that would be a surprise. NTSB has the flight recorder. They got that around 4, and it's being checked out right now. We've recovered just over 200 bodies."
"President Durling?"
Price handled that one with a shake of the head.
"Not yet. That's part of the building. Well, it's a mess, and they decided to wait for daylight to do the hard stuff."
"Survivors?"
"Just the 3 people who we know to have been inside that part of the building at the time of the crash."
"Okay." Ryan shook his head as well. "That information was important, but irrelevant."
"Anything important that we know?"
Murray consulted his notes. "The aircraft flew out of Vancouver International, B.C. They filed a false flight plan for London Heathrow, headed east. Departed Canadian airspace at 7:51 local time. All very routine stuff. We assume that he headed out a little while, reversed course, and headed southeast toward D.C. After that, he bluffed his way through air traffic control."
"How?"
Murray nodded to someone Ryan didn't know.
"Mr. President, I'm Ed Hutchins, NTSB. It's not hard. He claimed to be a KLM charter inbound to Orlando. Then he declared an emergency. When there's an in-flight emergency, our people are trained to get the airplane on the ground ASAP. We were up against a guy who knew all the right buttons to push. There's no way anyone could have prevented this," he concluded defensively.
"Only one voice on the tapes," Murray noted.
"Anyway," Hutchins continued, "we have tapes of the radar tracks. He simulated an aircraft with control difficulties, asked for an emergency vector to Andrews, and got what he wanted. From Andrews to the hill is barely a minute's flying time."
"One of our people got a stinger off," Price said, with somewhat forlorn pride.
Hutchins just shook his head. "It was the gesture for this morning in Washington."
"Against something that big, might as well have been a spitball."
"Anything from Japan?"
"They're in a national state of shock."
This came from Scott Adler, the senior career official in the State Department and one of Ryan's friends. "Right after you turned in, we got a call from the Prime Minister. It's not as though he hasn't had a bad week himself, though he sounds happy to be back in charge. He wants to come over to apologize personally to us. I told him we'd get back. Tell him yes."
"You sure, Jack?" Arnie Van Dam asked.
"Does anybody think this was a deliberate act?" Ryan countered.
"We don't know," Price responded first.
"No explosives aboard the aircraft," Dan Murray pointed out. "If there had been, I wouldn't be here." Ryan finished his coffee. The corporal refilled it at once.
"This is going to come down to 1 or 2 nuts, just like they all do."
Hutchins nodded tentative agreement.
"Explosives are fairly light, even a few tons, given the carrying capacity of the 747-400, would not have compromised the mission at all, and the payoff would have been enormous. What we have here is a fairly straightforward crash. The residual damage was done by about half a load of jet fuel, upwards of 80 tons. That was plenty," he concluded.
Hutchins had been investigating airplane accidents for almost 30 years.
"It's much too early to draw conclusions," Price warned.
"Scott?"
"If this was..." "Hell," Adler shook his head. "This was not an act by their government. They're frantic over there. The newspapers are calling for the heads of the people who suborned the government in the first place, and Prime Minister Koga was nearly in tears over the phone. Put it this way, if somebody over there planned this, they'll find out for us."
Their idea of due process isn't quite as stringent as ours, Mary added. Andrea is right. It is too early to draw conclusions, but all of the indications so far point to a random act, not a planned one. Murray paused for a moment. For that matter, we know the other side developed nuclear weapons, remember? Even the coffee turned cold with that remark. This one he found under a bush while moving a ladder from one part of the west face to another. The firefighter had been on duty for 7 straight hours. He was numb by now. You can take only so much horror before the mind starts regarding the bodies and pieces as mere things. The remains of a child might have shaken him, or even a particularly pretty female, since this fireman was still young and single. But the body he'd accidentally stepped on wasn't one of those. The torso was headless, and parts of both legs were missing. But it was clearly the body of a man, wearing the shredded remains of a white shirt, with epaulets at the shoulders. 3 stripes on each of them, he saw. He wondered what that meant, too tired to do much in the way of thinking. The fireman turned and waved to his lieutenant, who in turn tapped the arm of a woman wearing a vinyl FBI windbreaker. This agent walked over, sipping at a plastic cup and wishing she could light a cigarette. Still too many lingering fumes for that, she grumbled. Just found this one. Funny place, but... yeah, funny. The agent lifted her camera and snapped a couple of pictures which would have the exact time electronically preserved on the frame. Next, she took a pad from her pocket and noted the placement for body number 4 on her personal list. She hadn't seen many for her particular area of responsibility. Some plastic stakes and yellow tape would further mark the site. She started writing the tag for it. You can turn him over. Under the body, they saw, was an irregularly shaped piece of flat glass, or glass-like plastic. The agent snapped another photo, and through the viewfinder things somehow looked more interesting than with the naked eye. A glance up showed a gap in the marble balustrade. Another look around revealed a lot of small metallic objects, which an hour earlier she'd decided were aircraft parts, and which had attracted the attention of an NTSB investigator, who was now conferring with the same fire department officer with whom she'd been conferring a minute earlier. The agent had to wave 3 times to get his attention. "What is it?" The NTSB investigator was cleaning his glasses with a handkerchief. The agent pointed. "Check the shirt out." "Crew," the man said, after putting them back on. "Maybe a driver." "What's this?" It was his turn to point. There was a strange delicacy to it. The white uniform shirt had a hole in it just to the right of the pocket. The hole was surrounded by a red rust stain. The FBI agent held her flashlight close, and that showed that the stain was dried. The current temperature was just under 20 degrees. The body had been thrown into this harsh environment virtually at the moment of impact, and the blood about the severed neck was frozen, the purple-red color of some horrid plum sherbet. The blood on the shirt, she saw, had dried before having the chance to freeze. "Don't move the body anymore," she told the fireman. Like most FBI agents, she'd been a local police officer before applying to the federal agency. It was the cold that made her face pale. "First crash investigation?" the NTSB man asked, seeing her face, and mistaking her pallor. She nodded. "Yes, it is, but it's not my first murder." With that, she switched on her portable radio to call her supervisor. For this body, she wanted a crime scene team and full forensics. The telegrams came from every government in the world. Most were long, and all had to be read. Well, at least the ones from important countries. Togo could wait. Interior and Commerce are in town and standing by for a cabinet meeting along with all the deputies, Van Damme said, while Ryan flipped through the messages, trying to read and listen at the same time. The Joint Chiefs, all the vices, are assembled, along with all the command sinks to go over national security. Threat board? Jack asked without looking up. Until the previous day, he'd been President Durling's national security advisor, and it didn't seem likely that the world had changed too much in 24 hours. Scott Adler handled the answer. Clear. Washington is pretty much shut down, Murray said. Radio and TV announcements for people to stay home, except for essential services. The D.C. National Guard is out. We need the warm bodies for the Hill, and the D.C. Guard is a military police brigade. They might actually be useful. Besides, the firemen must be about worn out by now. How long before the investigation gives us hard information? The president asked. There's no telling that, Jack. Mr. Ryan looked up from the official Belgian telegram. How long since we've known each other, Dan? I'm not God, okay? If you use my name once in a while, nobody's going to shoot you for it. It was Murray's turn to smile. Okay. You can't predict with any major investigation. The breaks just come sooner or later, but they do come, Dan promised. We have a good team of investigators out there. What do I tell the media? Jack rubbed his eyes, already tired from reading. Maybe Kathy was right. Maybe he did need glasses, finally. Before him was a printed sheet for his morning TV appearances, which had been selected by lot. CNN at 7:08, CBS at 7:20, NBC at 7:37, ABC at 7:50, Fox at 8:08. All from the Roosevelt Room of the White House, where the cameras were already set up. Someone had decided that a formal speech was too much for him, and not really appropriate to the situation until he had something substantive to deliver. Just a quiet, dignified, and above all intimate introduction of himself to people reading their papers and drinking their morning coffee. Softball questions. That's already taken care of, Van Damme assured him. Answer them. Speak slowly, clearly. Look as relaxed as you can. Nothing dramatic. The people don't expect that. They want to know that somebody's in charge, answering the phones, whatever. They know it's too soon for you to say or do anything decisive. Rogers, kids? Still asleep, I expect. We have the family members in town. They're at the White House now. President Ryan nodded without looking up. It was hard to meet the eyes of the people sitting around the breakfast table, especially on things like that. There was a plan for this, too. Movers were already on the way, probably. The Durling family, what was left of it, would be removed from the White House kindly but quickly, because it wasn't their house anymore. The country needed someone else in there, and that someone needed to be as comfortable as possible. And that meant eliminating all visible reminders of the previous occupant. It wasn't brutal, Jack realized. It was business. They doubtless had a psychologist standing by to assist the family members with their grief, to process them through it as best as medical science allowed. But the country came first. In the unforgiving calculus of life, even so sentimental a nation as the United States of America had to move on. When it came time for Ryan to leave the White House, one way or another, the same thing would happen. There had been a time when an ex-president had walked down the hill to Union Station from his successor's inauguration to get a train ticket home. Now they used movers, and doubtless the family would fly out on Air Force transport. But go the children would, leaving behind schools and such friends as they had made, returning to California, and whatever life their family members could reconstruct for them. Business or not, it was cold, Ryan thought, while staring mindlessly at the Belgian telegram. How much the better for everyone if the aircraft had not fallen on the Capitol building. On top of all that, Jack had rarely been called upon to console the children of a man he knew, and damn sure hadn't ever taken their home away. He shook his head. It wasn't his fault.
but it was his job. The telegram he saw on returning to it noted that America had twice helped to save that small country within a space of less than 30 years, then protected it through the NATO alliance, that there was a bond of blood and friendship between America and a nation which most American citizens would have been taxed to locate on a globe. And that was true. Whatever the faults of his country, whatever her imperfections, however unfeeling some of her actions might seem to be, the United States of America had done the right thing more often than not. The world was far the better for it, and that was why business had to be carried out. Inspector Patrick O'Day was grateful for the cold. His investigative career had stretched over almost 30 years, and this was not his first time in the presence of multiple bodies and their separated parts. His first had been in Mississippi one May, a Sunday school bombed by the Ku Klux Klan with 11 victims. At least here the cold eliminated the ghastly odor of dead human bodies. He'd never really wanted a high rank in the Bureau. Inspector was a title with variable importance in the sense of seniority. In his case, much like Dan Murray, O'Day worked as a troubleshooter, often dispatched from Washington to assist on touchy ones. Widely recognized as a superb street agent, he'd been able to stick to real cases, large and small, instead of high-level supervision, which he found boring. Assistant Director Tony Caruso had gone along another track. He'd been special agent in charge of 2 field offices, risen to head the Bureau's training division, then taken over the Washington field office, which was sufficiently large to merit AD rank for its commander, along with one of the worst office locations in North America. Caruso enjoyed the power, prestige, higher pay, and reserved parking place which his status accorded him, but part of him envied his old friend Pat for his often dirty hands. "What do you figure?" Caruso asked, staring down at the body. They still needed artificial light. The sun was rising, but on the far side of the building. "You can't take it to court yet, but this guy was dead hours before the bird came down." Both men watched a gray-haired expert from Headquarters Laboratory Division hover over the body. There were all manner of tests to be carried out. Internal body temperature was one. A computer model allowed for environmental conditions, and while the data would be far less reliable than either senior official would want, anything prior to 9:46 p.m. the previous evening would tell them what they needed to know. "Knifed in the heart," Caruso said, shivering at the thought. You never really got over the brutality of murder. Whether a single person or 1,000, wrongful death was wrongful death, and the number just told you how many individual records had been tied. "We got the pilot." O'Day nodded. "I heard. 3 stripes makes him the co-pilot, and he was murdered. So maybe it was just one guy." "What's the crew on one of these?" Caruso asked the NTSB supervisor. 2. The earlier ones had a flight engineer, but the new ones don't bother with it. For really long flights, they might have a backup pilot. But these birds are pretty automated now, and the engines hardly ever break." The lab tech stood and waved in the people with the body bag before joining the others. "You want the early version?" "You bet," Caruso replied. "Definitely dead before the crash took place. No bruising from the crash trauma. The chest wound is relatively old. There should be contusions from the seat belts, but there aren't. Just scrapes and gouges, with damn little blood there. Not enough blood from the severed head. In fact, not enough blood anywhere in the remains right here. Let's say he was murdered in his seat in the aircraft. The belts hold him in a sitting position. Postmortem lividity drains all the blood down to the lower extremities, and the legs are torn off when the bird hits the building. That's why there's so little blood. I got a lot of homework to do, but quick and dirty, he was dead 3 hours at least before the plane got here." Will Geddes handed over the wallet. "Here's the guy's ID. Poor bastard. I guess he wasn't a part of this at all." What chance you could be wrong on any of that? O'Day had to ask.
I'd be real surprised, Pat. An hour or two on time of death, earlier rather than later. Yeah, that's possible. But there's nowhere near enough blood for this guy to have been alive at time of impact. He was dead before the crash. You can take that to the bank, Geddes told the other agents, knowing that his career rode on that one, and comfortable with the wager.
Thank God for that, Caruso breathed.
It did more than make things easier for the investigation. There would be conspiracy theories for the next 20 years, and the Bureau would proceed on its business, checking out every possibility, aided, they were sure, by the Japanese police. But one guy alone had driven this aircraft into the ground, and that made it extremely likely that this Grand Mal assassination, like most of the others, was the work of a single man, demented or not, skilled or not, but in any case alone. Not that everyone would ever believe that.
Get the information to Murray, Caruso ordered. He's with the President.
Yes, sir.
O'Day walked over toward where his diesel pickup was parked. He probably had the only one in town, the inspector thought, with a police light plugged into the cigarette lighter. You didn't put something like this over a radio, encrypted or not.
Rear Admiral Jackson changed into his blue mess jacket about 90 minutes out from Andrews, having managed about 6 hours of needed sleep after being briefed on things that didn't really matter very much. The uniform was the worse for having been packed in his travel bag, not that it would matter all that much, and the navy blue wool hid wrinkles fairly well anyway. His 5 rows of ribbons and wings of gold attracted the eye anyway. There must have been an easterly wind this morning, for the KC-10 flew in from Virginia, and a muttered, "Jesus, look at that," from a few rows aft, commanded all in the forward aft of the aircraft to crowd at the windows like the tourists they were not. Between the beginning of dawn and the huge collection of lights on the ground, it was plain that the Capitol building, the centerpiece of their country's first city, wasn't the same as it had been. Somehow, this was more immediate and real than the pictures many of them had seen on TV before boarding the plane in Hawaii. 5 minutes later, the aircraft touched down at Andrews Air Force Base. The senior officers found an aircraft of the Air Force's first heli squadron waiting to take them to the Pentagon's pad. This flight, lower and slower, gave them a better look still at the damage to the building.
"Jesus," Dave Seaton said over the intercom. "Did anybody get out of there alive?"
Robbie took his time before responding.
"I wonder where Jack was when it happened."
He remembered a British Army toast. "Here's to bloody wars and sickly seasons," which referred to a couple of sure ways for officers to be promoted into vacant slots. Surely quite a few people would fleet up from this incident, but none really wanted advancement this way, least of all his closest friend, somewhere down there in the wounded city.
The Marines looked very twitchy, Inspector O'Day saw. He parked his truck on 8th Street southeast. The Marine barracks were thoroughly barricaded. The curbs were fully blocked with parked cars, the gaps in the buildings doubly so. He dismounted his truck and walked toward an NCO. He was wearing his FBI windbreaker and carrying his ID in his right hand.
"I have business inside, Sergeant."
"Who with, sir?" the Marine asked, checking the photo against the face.
"Mr. Murray."
"You mind leaving your sidearm here with us, sir? Orders," the sergeant explained.
"Sure."
O'Day handed over his fanny pack, inside of which was his Smith & Wesson 1076 and 2 spare magazines. He didn't bother with a backup piece on headquarters duty.
"How many people you have around now?"
2 companies, near enough. There's another one setting up at the White House."
There was no better time to lock the barn door than after the horse got out, Pat knew. It was all the more grim since he was delivering the news that it was all unnecessary, but nobody would really care about that. The sergeant waved to a lieutenant who had nothing better to do. The NCOs ran things like this.
than to conduct visitors across the quad. The lieutenant saluted for no better reason than being a Marine.
"Here to see Daniel Murray. He's expecting me. Please follow me, sir."
The inner corners of the buildings on the quad had yet another line of Marines, with a third on the quad itself, complete with a heavy machine gun. Two companies amounted to upwards of 300 rifles. Yeah, President Ryan was fairly safe here, Inspector O'Day thought, unless some other maniac driving an airplane was around. Along the way, a captain wanted to compare the photo on his ID with the face again. It was being overdone. Somebody had to point that out before they started parking tanks on the street. Murray came out to meet him on the porch.
"How good is it?"
"Pretty good," the inspector replied.
"Come on."
Murray waved him in and led his friend into the breakfast room. "This is Inspector O'Day. Pat, I think you know who these people are."
"Good morning. I've been on the hill, and we found something a little while ago that you need to know," he began, going on for another couple of minutes.
"How solid is it?" Andrea Price asked.
"You know how this works," O'Day responded. "It's preliminary, but it looks pretty solid to me, and we'll have good test data after lunch. The ID's already being run. That may be a little shaky because we don't have a head to work with, and the hands are all ripped up. We're not saying that we've closed the case. We're saying that we have a preliminary indication that supports other data."
"Can I mention this on TV?" Ryan asked everyone around the table.
"Definitely not," Van Dam said.
"First, it's not confirmed. Second, it's too soon for anyone to believe it." Murray and O'Day traded a look. Neither of them was a politician. Arnie Van Dam was. For them, information control was about protecting evidence so that a jury saw it clean. For Arnie, information control was about protecting people from things he didn't think they could understand until it was spin-controlled and spoon-fed, one little gulp at a time. Both wondered if Arnie had ever been a father, and if his infant had starved to death waiting for his strained carrots. Both noted next that Ryan gave his chief of staff a long look. The well-known black box really wasn't much more than a tape recorder whose leads trailed off to the cockpit. There they collected data from engine and other flight controls, plus, in this case, the microphones for the flight crew. Japan Airlines was a government-run carrier, and its aircraft had the latest of everything. The flight data recorder was fully digitized. That made for rapid and clear transcription of the data. First of all, a senior technician made a clean, high-speed copy of the original metallic tape, which was then removed to a vault while he worked on the copy. Someone had thought to have a Japanese speaker standing by.
"This flight data looks like pure vanilla on first inspection. Nothing was broken on the aircraft," an analyst reported, scanning the data on a computer screen. "Nice easy turns, steady on the engines. Textbook flight profile. Until here," he tapped the screen. Here he made a radical turn from 067 to 196, and settles right back down again until his penetration. No chatter in the cockpit at all.
Another tech ran the voice segment of the tape back and forth, finding only routine traffic between the aircraft and various ground control stations. "I'm going to back it up to the beginning." The tape didn't really have a beginning. Rather, it ran on a continuous loop on this machine because the 747 routinely engaged in long overwater flights, 40 hours long. It took several minutes for him to locate the end of the immediately preceding flight, and here he found the normal exchange of information and commands between two crewmen, and also between the aircraft and the ground, the former in Japanese and the latter in English, the language of international aviation. That stopped soon after the aircraft had halted at its assigned jetway. There was a full 2 minutes of blank tape, and then the recording cycle began again when the flight deck instruments were powered up during the pre-flight procedures. The Japanese speaker, an Army officer in civilian clothes, was from the National Security Agency. The sound pickup was excellent. They could hear the clicks of switches being thrown, and the background whirs of various instruments. But the loudest sound was the breathing of the co-pilot, whose identity was specified by the track on the recording tape.
"Stop," the Army officer said. "Back it up a little. There's another voice. Can't quite..." "Oh, okay. All ready?" Question mark. "Must be the pilot." "Yeah, that was a door closing. Pilot just came in." "Pre-flight checklist complete. Standing by for before start checklist." "Oh. Oh, God, he killed him." "Back it up again."
The officer, a major, didn't see the FBI agent don a second pair of headphones. It was a first for both of them. The FBI agent had seen a murder on a bank video system, but neither he nor the intelligence officer had ever heard one. A grunt from an impact, a gasp of breath that conveyed surprise and pain, a gurgle, maybe an attempt at speech, followed by another voice.
"What's that?" the agent asked. "Run it again."
The officer's face stared at the wall. "I am very sorry to do this." That was followed by a few more labored breaths, then a long sigh. "Jesus." The second voice came on a different Vox channel less than a minute later to notify the tower that the 747 was starting its engines.
"That's the pilot, Sato," the NTSB analyst said. "The other voice must be the co-pilot." "Not anymore."
The only remaining noise over the co-pilot's channel was spillover and background sounds.
"Killed him," the FBI agent agreed.
They'd have to run the tape 100 more times, for themselves and for others, but the conclusion would be the same. Even though the formal investigation would last for several months, the case was effectively closed less than 9 hours after it had begun. The streets of Washington were eerily empty. Normally, at this time of day, Ryan knew all too well from his own experience, the nation's capital was gridlocked with the automobiles of federal employees, lobbyists, members of Congress and their staffers, 50,000 lawyers and their secretaries, and all the private industry service workers who supported them all. Not today. With every intersection manned by a radio car of the Metropolitan Police or a camouflage-painted National Guard vehicle, it was more like a holiday weekend, and there was actually more traffic heading away from the hill than toward it. The curious turned away from their place of interest 10 blocks from their intended destination. The presidential procession headed up Pennsylvania. Jack was back in the Chevy Suburban, and there were still Marines leading and following the collection of Secret Service vehicles. The sun was up now. The sky was mainly clear, and it took a moment to realize that the skyline was wrong. The 747 hadn't even harmed the trees, Ryan saw. It hadn't wasted its energy on anything but the target. Half a dozen cranes were working now, lifting stone blocks from the crater that had been the house chamber, depositing them onto trucks that were taking them off somewhere. Only a few fire trucks remained. The dramatic part was over for now. The grim part remained. The rest of the city seemed intact enough at 6:40 a.m. Ryan gave the hill a final sideways look through the darkened windows as his vehicle headed downhill on Constitution Avenue. If cars were being turned away, the usual morning collection of joggers was not. Perhaps they'd run to the mall as part of the normal morning ritual, but there they stopped. Ryan watched their faces, some of which turned to see his vehicle pass before returning their gaze eastward, talking in little knots, pointing and shaking their heads. Jack noticed that the Secret Service agents in the Suburban with him turned to watch them, perhaps expecting one to pull a bazooka from under his sweats. It was novel to drive so fast in Washington. Partly it was because a rapidly moving target was harder to hit, and partly because Ryan's time was far more valuable now, and not to be wasted.
More than anything else, it meant that he was speeding toward something he would just as soon have avoided. Only a few days before, he'd accepted Roger Durling's invitation for the vice presidency. But he'd done so mainly as a means of relieving himself from government service once and for all. That thought evoked a pained look behind closed eyes. Why was it that he'd never been able to run away from anything? Certainly it didn't seem like courage. It actually seemed the reverse. He'd so often been afraid, afraid to say no and have people think him a coward. Afraid to do anything but what his conscience told him. And so often what it had told him had been something he hated to do or was afraid to do. But there wasn't ever an honorable alternative that he could exercise. "It'll be okay," Van Damme told him, seeing the look, and knowing what the new president had to be thinking. "No, it won't," Jack could not reply. Chapter 3. Scrutiny. The Roosevelt Room is named for Teddy, and on the east wall was his Nobel Peace Prize for his successful mediation of the Russo-Japanese War. Historians could now say that the effort had only encouraged Japan's imperial ambitions, and so wounded the Russian soul that Stalin, hardly a friend of the Romanov dynasty, had felt the need to avenge his country's humiliation. But that particular bequest of Alfred Nobel had always been more political than real. The room was used for medium-sized lunches and meetings, and was conveniently close to the Oval Office. Getting there proved to be harder than Jack had expected. The corridors of the White House are narrow for such an important building, and the Secret Service was out in force, though here their firearms were not in evidence. That was a welcome relief. Ryan walked past 10 new agents over and above those who had formed his mobile guard force, which evoked a sigh of exasperation from swordsmen. Everything was new and different now, and the protective detail that in former times had seemed businesslike, sometimes even amusing, was just one more reminder that his life had been traumatically changed. "Now what?" Jack asked. "This way." An agent opened a door, and Ryan found the presidential makeup artist. It was an informal arrangement, and the artist, a woman in her 50s, had everything in a large fake leather case. As often as he'd done TV, rather a lot in his former capacity as National Security Advisor, it was something Jack had never come to love, and it required all of his self-control not to fidget as the liquid base was applied with a foam sponge, followed by powder and hairspray and fussing, all of which was done without a word by a woman who looked as though she might burst into tears at any moment. "I liked him, too," Jack told her. Her hand stopped, and their eyes met. "He was always so nice. He hated this, just like you do. But he never complained, and he usually had a joke to tell. Sometimes I'd do the children just for fun. They liked it, even the boy. They'd play in front of the TV, and the crews would give them tapes, and..." "It's okay." Ryan took her hand. Finally, he'd met someone on the staff who wasn't all business, and who didn't make him feel like an animal in the zoo. "What's your name?"
"Mary Abbott."
Her eyes were running, and she wanted to apologize. "How long have you been here?"
"Since right before Mr. Carter left."
Mrs. Abbott wiped her eyes and steadied down. "Well, maybe I should ask you for advice," he said gently.
"Oh, no, I don't know anything about that."
She managed an embarrassed smile. "Neither do I. I guess I'll just have to find out." Ryan looked in the mirror. "Finished?"
"Yes, Mr. President."
"Thank you, Mrs. Abbott." They sat him in an armed wooden chair. The lights were already set up, which brought the room temperature into the low 80s, or so it felt. A technician clipped a two-headed microphone to his tie with movements as delicate as Mrs. Abbott's, all because there was a Secret Service agent hovering over every member of the crew, with Andrea Price hovering over them all from the doorway.
Her eyes were narrow and suspicious, despite the fact that every single piece of gear in the room had been inspected, every visitor scanned continuously by eyes as casually intense and thorough as a surgeon's. One really could make a pistol out of non-metallic composites. The movie was right about that. But pistols were still bulky. The palpable tension of the detail carried over to the TV crew, who kept their hands in the open, and only moved them slowly. The scrutiny of the Secret Service could rattle almost anyone.
2 minutes, the producer said, cued by his earpiece. Just went into commercial.
Get any sleep last night? CNN's chief White House correspondent asked. Like everyone else, he wanted a quick and clear read on the new president.
Not enough, Jack replied, suddenly tense.
There were two cameras. He crossed his legs and clasped his hands in his lap in order to avoid nervous movements. How exactly was he supposed to appear? Grave? Grief-stricken? Quietly confident? Overwhelmed? It was a little late for that now. Why hadn't he asked Ernie before?
30 seconds, the producer said.
Jack tried to compose himself. His physical posture would keep his body still.
Just answer the questions. You've been doing that long enough.
8 minutes after the hour, the correspondent said directly into the camera behind Jack. We're here in the White House with President John Ryan.
Mr. President, it's been a long night, hasn't it?
I'm afraid it has, Ryan agreed.
What can you tell us?
Recovery operations are underway, as you know. President Durling's body has not yet been found. The investigation is going on under the coordination of the FBI.
Have they discovered anything?
We'll probably have a few things to say later today, but it's too early right now.
Despite the fact that the correspondent had been fully briefed on that issue, Ryan saw the disappointment in his eyes.
Why the FBI? Isn't the Secret Service empowered to...
This is no time for a turf fight. An investigation like this has to go on at once. Therefore, I decided that the FBI would be the lead agency, under the Department of Justice, and with the assistance of other federal agencies.
We want answers. We want them fast, and this seems the best way to make that happen.
It's been reported that you've appointed a new FBI director.
Jack nodded.
Yes, Barry, I have.
For the moment, I've asked Daniel E. Murray to step in as acting director. Dan is a career FBI agent whose last job was special assistant to Director Shaw. We've known each other for many years. Mr. Murray is one of the best cops in government service.
Murray? A policeman, supposed to be an expert on terrorism and espionage, the intelligence officer replied.
Hmm.
He went back to sipping his bittersweet coffee.
What can you tell us about preparation for... I mean, for the next several days, the correspondent asked next.
Barry, those plans are still being made. First and foremost, we have to let the FBI and other law enforcement agencies do their job. There will be more information coming out later today, but it's been a long and difficult night for a lot of people.
The correspondent nodded at that and decided it was time for a human interest question.
Where did you and your family sleep? I know it wasn't here.
The Marine barracks at 8th and I, Ryan answered.
Oh, shit, boss, Andrea Price muttered, just outside the room.
Some media people had found out, but the service hadn't confirmed it to anyone, and most news organizations had reported that the Ryan family was at an undisclosed location.
Well, they'd be sleeping somewhere else tonight, and the location would not be disclosed this time.
Damn.
Why there?
Well, it had to be somewhere, and that seemed convenient.
I was a Marine myself once, Barry, Jack said quietly.
Remember when we blew them up?
A fine night.
The intelligence officer remembered watching through binoculars from the top of the Beirut Holiday Inn. He'd helped set that mission up.
The only hard part, really, had been selecting the driver. There was an odd cachet about the American Marines, something seemingly mystical about them that this Ryan's nation clung to. But they died just like any other infidel. He wondered with amusement if there might be a large truck in Washington that one of his people might buy or lease. He set the amusing thought aside. There was work to be done. It wasn't practical anyway. He'd been to Washington more than once, and the Marine barracks was one of the places he'd examined. It was too easily defended. Too bad, really. The political significance of the target made it highly attractive. "Not smart," Ding observed over his morning coffee. "Expect him to hide?" Clark asked.
"You know him, Daddy?" Patricia asked.
"Yes, as a matter of fact. Ding and I used to look after him back when we were SPOs. I knew his father once," John added without thinking, which was very unusual for him.
"What's he like, Ding?" Patty asked her fiancé, the ring still fresh on her finger.
"Pretty smart," Chavez allowed. "Kind of quiet. Nice guy, always has a kind word. Well, usually." "He's been tough when he had to be," John observed with an eye to his partner, and soon-to-be son-in-law, which thought almost occasioned a chill. Then he saw the look in his daughter's eyes, and the chill became quite real. "Damn." "That's a fact," the junior man agreed. The lights made him sweat under his makeup, and Ryan fought the urge to scratch the itches on his face. He managed to keep his hand still, but his facial muscles began a series of minor twitches that he hoped the camera didn't catch. "I'm afraid I can't say, Barry," he went on, holding his hands tightly together. "It's just too soon to respond substantively to a lot of questions right now. When we're able to give hard answers, we will. Until then, we won't." "You have a big day ahead," the CNN reporter said sympathetically. "Barry, we all do." "Thank you, Mr. President." He waited until the light went off, and he heard a voiceover from the Atlanta headquarters before speaking again. "Good one. Thank you." Van Damme came in then, pushing Andrea Price aside as he did so. Few could touch a Secret Service agent without seriously adverse consequences, much less bustle one, but Arnie was one who could. "Pretty good. Don't do anything different. Answer the questions. Keep your answers short." Mrs. Abbott came in next to check Ryan's makeup. A gentle hand touched his forehead while the other adjusted his hair with a small brush. Even for his high school prom. What was her name? Ryan asked himself irrelevantly. Neither he nor anyone else had been so fussy about his coarse black hair. Under other circumstances, it would have been something to laugh about. The CBS anchor was a woman in her middle thirties, and proof positive that brains and looks were not mutually exclusive. "Mr. President, what is left of the government?" she asked after a couple of conventional get-acquainted questions.
"Maria?" Ryan had been instructed to address each reporter by the given name. He didn't know why, but it seemed reasonable enough. "As horrid as the last 12 hours have been for all of us, I want to remind you of a speech President Durling gave a few weeks ago. America is still America. All of the federal executive agencies will be operating today under the leadership of the sitting deputy secretaries, but Washington, for reasons of public safety, Washington is pretty well shut down, that is true." She cut him off again, less from ill manners than from the fact that she only had 4 minutes to use, and she wanted to use them. "The troops in the street?" "Maria, the D.C. police and fire departments had the roughest night of all. It's been a long, cold night for those people. The Washington, D.C. National Guard has been called out to assist the civilian agencies. That also happens after hurricanes and tornadoes. In fact, that's really a municipal function. The FBI is working with the mayor to get the job done." It was Ryan's longest statement of the morning, and almost left him breathless, he was wound so tightly. That was when he realized that he was squeezing his hands to the point that his fingers were turning white, and Jack had to make a conscious effort to relax them.
"Look at his arms," the Prime Minister observed. "What do we know of this Ryan?"
The chief of her country's intelligence service had a file folder in his lap, which he had already memorized, having had the luxury of a working day to familiarize himself with the new chief of state.
"He's a career intelligence officer. You know about the incident in London and later in the States some years ago." "Oh, yes," she noted, sipping her tea and dismissing that bit of history. "So, a spy?"
"A well-regarded one. Our Russian friends think very highly of him indeed. So does Century House," said the army general, whose training went back to the British tradition. Like his prime minister, he'd been educated at Oxford, and, in his case, Sandhurst. "He is highly intelligent. We have reason to believe that in his capacity as Derling's national security adviser, he was instrumental in controlling American operations against Japan."
"And us?" she asked, her eyes locked on the screen.
How convenient it was to have communication satellites, and the American networks were all global now. Now you didn't have to spend a whole day in an aircraft to go and see a rival chief of state, and then under controlled circumstances. Now she could see the man under pressure and gauge how he responded to it. Career intelligence officer or not, he didn't look terribly comfortable. Every man had his limitations.
"Undoubtedly, Prime Minister."
"He is less formidable than your information would suggest," she told her advisor. Tentative, uncomfortable, rattled, out of his depth.
"When do you expect to be able to tell us more about what happened?" Maria asked.
"I really can't say right now. It's just too soon. Some things can't be rushed, I'm afraid," Ryan said. He vaguely grasped that he'd lost control of this interview, short as it was, and wasn't sure why. It never occurred to him that the TV reporters were lined up outside the Roosevelt Room like shoppers in a checkout line, that each one wanted to ask something new and different, after the first question or two, and that each wanted to make an impression, not on the new president, but on the viewers, the unseen people behind the cameras who watched each morning show out of loyalty, which the reporters had to strengthen whenever possible. As gravely wounded as the country was, reporting the news was the business which put food on their family tables, and Ryan was just one more subject of that business. That was why Arnie's earlier advice on how they'd been instructed on what questions to ask had been overly optimistic, even coming from an experienced political pro. The only really good news was that the interviews were all time-limited, in this case by local news delivered by the various network affiliates at 25 minutes after the hour. Whatever tragedy had struck Washington, people needed to know about local weather and traffic in the pursuit of their daily lives, a fact perhaps lost on those inside the D.C. Beltway, though not lost on the local stations across the country. Maria was more gracious than she felt when the director cut her off. She smiled at the camera. "We'll be back." And Ryan had 12 minutes until NBC had at him. The coffee he'd had at breakfast was working on him now, and he needed to find a bathroom. But when he stood, the microphone wire nearly tripped him. "This way, Mr. President," Price pointed to the left, down the corridor, then right toward the Oval Office, Jack realized too late. He stopped cold on entering the room. It was still someone else's in his mind, but a bathroom was a bathroom, and in this case it was actually part of a sitting room off the office itself. Here, at least, there was privacy, even from the Praetorian Guard, which followed him like a pack of collies protecting a particularly valuable sheep. Jack didn't know that when there was someone in this particular head, a light on the upper door frame lit up, and that a peephole in the office door allowed the Secret Service to know even that aspect of their president's daily life. Washing his hands, Ryan looked in the mirror, always a mistake at times like this. The makeup made him appear more youthful than he was, which wasn't so bad, but also phony. The false ruddiness which his skin had never had. He had to fight off the urge to wipe it all off before coming back out to face NBC. This anchor was a black male, and on shaking hands with him back in the Roosevelt room, it was of some consolation that his makeup was even more grotesque than his own. Jack was oblivious to the fact that the TV lights so affected the human complexion that to appear normal on a television screen, one had to appear the clown to non-electronic eyes. "What will you be doing today, Mr. President?" Nathan asked as his fourth question. "I have another meeting with Acting FBI Director Murray. Actually, we'll be meeting twice a day for a while. I also have a scheduled session with the National Security Staff, then with some of the surviving members of Congress. This afternoon we have a cabinet meeting." "Funeral arrangements?" The reporter checked off another question from the list in his lap. Ryan shook his head. "Too soon. I know it's frustrating for all of us, but these things do take time." He didn't say that the White House Protocol Office had 15 minutes of his afternoon to brief him on what was being planned. "It was a Japanese airliner, and in fact a government-owned carrier. Do we have any reason to suspect?" Ryan leaned forward on that one. "No, Nathan, we don't. We've had communications with the Japanese government. Prime Minister Koga has promised full cooperation, and we are taking him at his word. I want to emphasize that hostilities with Japan are completely over. What happened was a horrible mistake. That country is working to bring to justice the people who caused that conflict to take place. We don't yet know how everything happened. Last night, I mean. But don't know means don't know. Until we do, I want to discourage speculation. That can't help anything, but it can hurt, and there's been enough hurt for a while. We have to think about healing now." "Domo arigato," muttered the Japanese Prime Minister. It was the first time he'd seen Ryan's face or heard his voice. Both were younger than he'd expected, though he'd been informed of Ryan's particulars earlier in the day. Kogan noted the man's tension and unease, but when he had something to say other than an obvious answer to an inane question, why did the Americans tolerate the insolence of their media? The voice changed somewhat, as did the eyes. The difference was subtle, but Koga was a man accustomed to noting the smallest of nuance. It was one advantage of growing up in Japan, and all the more so for having spent his adult life in politics. "He was a formidable enemy," a foreign ministry official noted quietly. "And in the past he showed himself to be a man of courage." Koga thought about the papers he'd read 2 hours earlier. This Ryan had used violence, which the Japanese Prime Minister abhorred. But he had learned from 2 shadowy Americans who had probably saved his life from his own countrymen that violence had a place, just as surgery did, and Ryan had taken violent action to protect others, suffered in the process, then done so again before returning to peaceful pursuits. Yet again he displayed the same dichotomy, against Koga's country, fighting with skill and ruthlessness, then showing mercy and consideration. A man of courage. And honor, I think. Koga paused for a moment. So strange that there should already be friendship between 2 men who had never met, and who had only a week before been at war. He is samurai. The ABC correspondent, female and blonde, had the name of Joy, which for some reason struck Ryan as utterly inappropriate to the day, but it was probably the name her parents had given her, and that was that. If Maria from CBS had been pretty, Joy was stunning, and perhaps a reason ABC had the top-rated morning show.
Her hello handshake was warm and friendly, and something else that almost made Jack's heart stop.
"Good morning, Mr. President," she said softly, in a voice better suited to a dinner party than a morning TV news show.
"Please."